Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. A year after the Maui wildfires, ABC's Becky Worley returns to the Hawaiian island where she grew up.
Sacred Heart School, where I once went, still in rubble. It's my first time seeing the damage here.
I didn't even recognize this. So this is where I went to second grade.
Rebuilding could take 3 to 5 years. Since the fire, students and teachers making do in outdoor classrooms. But just this week, Sacred Heart's welcoming 185 students to their new semi-permanent campus.
The wildfires began a year ago today. Tropical Depression Debbie is headed to the northeast after dumping heavy rain and triggering flooding and a number of tornadoes in North Carolina. Special Counsel Jack Smith requesting a delay to respond to a scheduling order from Judge Tanya Chutkan, who is once again overseeing former President Trump's federal election interference case. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Universities of Wisconsin President Jay Rothman says he'll ask for more money in the next state budget. He told a legislative study committee Thursday the state needs to increase its investment in its public universities if they're going to stay competitive. Wisconsin ranks 43rd in the country in supporting four-year schools. Primary election day is Tuesday. There are bilingual ballots for those who need them, Brittany Merlot explains.
In Marathon County, some Spanish-speaking information is given to voters. But if a non-English speaker needs additional assistance to vote, some exceptions can be made. First, they can bring a translator with them, all the way to the polling booth. This person, though, cannot be a boss or an employer. And if you speak Hmong, you can go to the Hmong American Center in Wausau. I'm Brittany Merlot.
And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
A lot of people, I think, are going to be seeing Twisters this weekend. I mean, the movie.
Welcome to Merlot at the Movies. So without spoilers, what did you think?
I actually really, really, really loved it. When it came down to the science, what they were talking about, the tips and tricks, I was impressed. It really helps, too, with people that are scared of storms. If you do want the full effect, see it in theaters.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 until 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Don't know if you've noticed. Not sure if Donald and the Red Hats have noticed. But hers are, well, much, much bigger. And look, I know Donald loves to measure size. And I got to tell you, hers is bigger. Hers are bigger. She's really, to turn a phrase, whipping it out, and in a big way. Crowds are showing up, and look, the J.D. Vance thing in Philadelphia, how weird was that? And again, as IATSE pointed out, the stagehands union, this is what happens when you use scab labor to not position your sign right, so that it looked like J.D. Vance was out there campaigning for Kamala, and maybe he should be, because the rest of the country's, I think they're on the walls, Kamala Harris Walls train. And look, for me, this is first Gen X president, first Gen X administration. This is kind of a big deal. This is the, you know, how do they say mess around and find out? This is the mess around and find out generation. And look, I love the fact that they're coming out and you know, as I've said in the past about Democrats, you know, in a street fight, they're willing to hold your coat. I look at these two. They'll hold your coat long enough to throw it on the ground before they kick you in the behind. And that is about time that Democrats start standing up and fighting for policies and doing it in an aggressive way. Look, I love Joe Biden, but you know, Joe did amazing transformational stuff but just did it in a nice old school way. I think these two, I think they're going to start kicking in some doors and some taking some names, starting with Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. And look, I love the choice of Tim Walz. What this tells me is that Kamala Harris is secure enough to go, you know what? I want someone who's dynamic. I want someone who people are going to love. I want someone who's going to challenge me to do more. I want somebody who's going to make America great. And that's these two. And as I've said in the past, I think Joe Biden has done an incredible job. The convention should have an entire day of how wonderful Joe Biden has been, how transformational this administration has been, and start the push to get him on Mount Rushmore and named for every school and bridge and all of that. And oh, by the way, I had a number of people email me and say, hey, this Walz guy sounds a lot like you, old Gen X, curmudgeon-y white guy fighting for workers' rights. Yes. That is a great thing. It's about damn time. And, you know, he took my idea and ran with it. He was talking about a bridge that, you know, was going between Minnesota and Wisconsin. Biden gave $1 billion to each of the states, threw money into, done with a project labor agreement under prevailing wage, created great jobs. But what did he do? Bought a giant Joe Biden sign and said, Biden did this. That's the kind of guy I want in those positions. That's the kind of politician we should want across the board. Not them. Which, again, weird. I mean, you know, Tim Walz's frame of weird kind of plays, doesn't it? These are some weird people. So, good stuff. I got to tell you, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Stephen Greenhouse is going to be here to share some thoughts on the Walz pick. Also on Project 2025, which is kind of fallen a little bit in the information as people are excited about Harris Walz. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, but a couple of good days for labor voices. A lot of my labor friends thrilled to death over the VP choice of Tim Walz, especially the folks in Minnesota who have reached out to me with nothing but effusive praise. And in fact, yesterday on the program, we talked a lot about Walz and this being the kind of guy that we want at every level of political power, someone who actually does know what it's like to have to worry about the paycheck at the end of the week and what it's going to be like to maybe not be able to make the bills. A guy who's, I don't know, radical and extremely normal. And here to share some thoughts on, well, this pick and what it could mean for this ticket going forward. I've asked my good friend Stephen Greenhouse to come share some thoughts. He's got a couple of incredible pieces out that have to be read. A Guardian piece over at The Guardian that Trump's claims he's pro-worker. Project 2025, got to gut labor rights. And now he's got a Slate piece out on Tim Walz. Again, a must-read. We'll get links out. Stephen, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. So I agree, Rick. Kamala Harris's selection of Tim Walz is very good for workers, is very good for unions. And you know, he's in ways the perfect choice for workers. Perfect's a big word, but an extremely good choice for workers in many ways. One, he was a union member for 20 years, and he was a high school teacher, taught social studies, captain of a football team, won state championship, which is great. And he appreciated what his union did for him. I was just looking at a video he did some years back. After he served in the Army National Guard and was discharging many ordnances, you know, he went deaf, largely deaf. And then he says in this video that thanks to his very good union healthcare plan, he was able to get his ears operated on and restored his hearing. And for the first time, he could hear his four-year-old daughter singing in bed in the morning, which he had never heard before. Just very moving about unions and what unions and health coverage do for you. Second, you know, as governor, he's done maybe more than any other governor to help workers and unions. Why do I say that? Under him, you know, he was elected in 2018, November 2022. The Democrats won control of both houses of the Minnesota legislature. Like, he wasn't going to waste his time. He was going to use his political capital to get things done for the citizens and the workers of Minnesota. So they passed 12 weeks paid family and medical leave. They have free school breakfast and lunches for all kids. So the kids who are poor don't have to feel bad when they're getting free lunches and the richer kids. So that's been great. They passed great rules to help construction workers. So many construction contractors are very shady and cheat their workers. So under this new law, the real estate developers and the general contractors, they're to be held liable too if their subcontractors cheat the hell out of workers. They passed a paid sick days bill where every worker could get up to paid sick, you know, up to six paid sick days. They call it sick and safe days, you know, right, where you can take off work, not just if you're sick, but but if you need counseling about something, or if you face domestic abuse or sexual abuse, you can take time off. So that's very good. And on union stuff, they expanded the collective bargaining rights for teachers so that teachers can negotiate over class size, class ratio size between educators and students. And also, Minnesota was the first state to ban the detested captive audience meetings where management, where corporations, you know, haul 1,500 workers into a room and they hear this high paid anti-union consultant telling them that, you know, unions are the worst thing since hell was invented. You know, so the Minnesota passed a law under him that says, you know, companies can't require workers to hear this anti-union stuff. And the third reason that I think Walz is a very good idea is, like, he's a typical guy. You know, he hunts, he fishes. I just saw his financial disclosure form. He owns no stocks. He sold his home for less than $315,000. Sold it for under $300,000. And he just has this governor's mansion. So when he's done being governor, you know, he really doesn't own a home. And he's not a billionaire like Trump. He's not supported by billionaires like J.D. Vance. He's a regular guy, and he's the type of guy, as they say, that you'd be happy to drink, you know, have a beer with.
Said that yesterday.
Yeah.
And no, he's the guy who in front of you, the checkout line.
Rick, forgive me.
No, he's the guy at the checkout line in front of you that you wouldn't even recognize. He's that normal. He's that much of a regular guy, which is why I think it's important to have that kind of a voice there. And for me, the other part of it is he was a football coach. And one of the things that's been driving me crazy about Democrats is this. The phrase I've often used is Democrats in a street fight will offer to hold your coat. This is a guy who I think will offer to hold your coat long enough to throw it on the ground before he stomps all over you. And I'm hoping the era of when they go low, we go high is over. I hope when they go low, we stomp them into the ground. And I think he is that guy.
There was a great line, and I don't know if you and your listeners listened to the Philadelphia rally yesterday, but Walz had this great line saying, you know, people shouldn't forget that when Trump was president, you know, crime actually went up significantly in the United States. And that's not including all the crimes that Donald Trump committed himself. That was a great line. And
that was a good line.
You know, that's not going low, but that's not going high, but it's great humor.
No, but it's fighting back. It's pushing back in a way that you know, says, hey, we're here. And I thought the couch comment, you know, I thought that was a little clever.
Yeah, it was clever. But yeah, low blow, clever. Yeah, below the belt, so to speak. And another thing, so I have been known to complain to friends that, you know, while Hillary Clinton, you know, was, you know, good woman, and John Kerry was a good guy, and Al Gore was a good guy, and Tim Kaine I've always liked, and Joe Lieberman, I used to like him. But like, these were elite lawyers, you know, Ivy League educated.
Mother May I types.
They weren't the type of people that many Americans, many blue collar people in the Midwest, many blue collar folks anywhere in the country would relate to. And Tim Walz is different. You know, the Democrats often say, you know, we were the party of the working class. We want to be the party of the working class, but they've increasingly been seen as the party of the coastal elites. But Tim Walz is, you know, grew up on a farm in a town of 300 in Nebraska. He said it was a town where everyone looked out for each other, all for one, one for all. And like, he's what I think the Democratic Party, should be about, is about. And the crazy thing is we hear Trump condemning the coastal elites. Trump went to the fanciest business school in the world, University of Pennsylvania, Yale, Ivy League, Wharton School. J.D. Vance went to Yale Law School. These are, and, you know, Trump's, you know, Trump was raised by a guy worth hundreds of millions of dollars and became a billionaire. J.D. Vance, you know, got into politics because he's supported by right-wing billionaires. And he has Kamala Harris. You know, she went to Howard University, not an Ivy League school.
Walz got his degree on the GI Bill.
The Charlton or something, a school I never heard of. You know, he's not a fancy dancy coastal elite. So like, the Republican Party is full of it when they say, oh, the Democrats are the coastal elite. You know, they're trying to flip the script on reality.
No, for me, this is that moment where Democrats, and this is why I think Kamala Harris, you know, knocked it out of the park with this first real decision. She could have gone with a safer pick. She could have gone with a more conservative, moderate pick. She could have done a whole bunch of things. But I think this choice says, hey, we're going to roll up our sleeves and we're going to go fight in areas that maybe Democrats haven't been competitive. I don't know, like my backyard here in rural Pennsylvania.
That's true. The hope is that she will broaden the map, that the Democratic ticket will broaden the map. But maybe, you know, with this guy who grew up, you know, in the sticks, grew up in rural America, grew up in Nebraska, and was a, you know, typical worker, not making tons of money as a teacher, that he's the type of, you know, working class blue collar person that Americans relate to. And maybe, you know, maybe they're Democrats will be making inroads again in some states that have flipped Republican, maybe a state like Iowa, maybe a state like Missouri, who knows?
No, he's that kind of guy.
You know, I was discussing with a prominent political consultant today, like, you know, it's hard for me to believe that, you know, some blue collar people who are open to Trump won't also be open to hearing Tim Walz. And, you know, when Tim Kaine went to, you know, Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Youngstown, I don't, you know, I respect Tim Kaine, but he's not the type of guy that working class people are going to run to hear. But Tim Walz, I think people feel he's like us. Plus, Tim Walz is a marvelous speaker with a marvelous sense of humor and can be very cutting. And I think he's going to attract a lot of people to his rallies.
No, he got me. Look, I had a bunch of listeners, you know, after his speech, you know, send me the links going, he sounds just like you. This is and understand the line in the whole speech that caught my attention wasn't the crime one or the couch one. It's the mind your own damn business one.
Yeah.
For me, that's, I've been saying that for years. Don't worry about me. Worry about yourself. Worry about what goes on inside your four walls. Let other people lead their lives. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Leave them alone. Get out of my life. Don't worry about me. And I think by him saying that, I'm hoping that's the pathway forward.
Yeah, I think the Democrats increasingly have some good lines. We're not going back. If you fight, you win. And now mind your own business. You know, again, the Republicans have this myth that they're the party of freedom, right? And the Democrats, you know, all about government control. You know, it's the Republicans who want to go into the bedroom and tell women what they can and cannot do with their bodies. It's the Republicans who want to go into the schools and say, this is how you teach about race. We don't want you to teach about this, about slavery. And the Republicans are the one, or many of the Republicans, they're the folks who are trying to ban books. Democrats want greater freedom for many Americans.
Now let's flip to the other side, because, you know, Walz has an incredible record. I would argue probably only, I'm going to go a little, maybe only second to Michigan what Michigan did after Whitmer and the Democrats took power there, because they did repeal right to work. So right. I'm gonna bump that up.
Minnesota never had right to work. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna bump that up just a little bit because they did do that. But you know,
Michigan's done great stuff.
But it's that kind of, we got to do stuff that's important, and that's part of this. But I look at what Republicans want to do, and they've laid it out meticulously in 900 plus pages telling us what they want to do to this country. And when people find out what's in it, the polling overwhelmingly is negative, especially on the labor side. I tell my red hat friends, they want to do away with prevailing wage. You want to do away with project labor agreements. They want company unions. They want suggestion box unions, not the one that you're used to, but ones where you go hat in hand begging instead of making demands. I think that's got to be played as well.
Sure. So that's why I wrote this big piece explaining Project 2025. And I really, you know, went with a fine tooth comb through its labor chapter. And, you know, one of the crazy things is Trump says, I'm the best friend of workers. I, unlike the Democrats, care about the forgotten men and women. J.D. Vance pretends he's this great working class populist. And then you read Project 2025, which was written, let's not kid ourselves, by dozens of Trump allies, dozens of people who'd served in the Trump administration. And if Trump wins, many of them will be in his new administration trying to enforce, institute, impose what's in Project 2025. So what's in Project 2025? It wants to greatly increase child labor and dangerous jobs. You know, clearly some companies are complaining that they're having a hard time finding enough workers because the unemployment rate has been so low in the Biden-Harris administration. So they said, we want to hire these kids and we want to, remove these restrictions that make it illegal to have 16 and 17 year olds work in very dangerous jobs, like say a metal stamping plant or an auto plant. And you read the language, it's like, it shows no concern about the dangers that these industrial hazards have for kids. It's all about, we have to open the door to welcome the kids to these dangerous jobs. It's like mind-boggling. It's like we haven't, gone through the fight to stop child labor in the United States and Bangladesh and elsewhere. Second, you read about all these construction workers who support Trump. But, for construction workers, Project 2025 sucks incredibly. It wants to get rid of prevailing wage. So in all these government projects, you don't have to pay the prevailing standard wage. Instead, contractors bidding can, like, instead of paying $25 an hour, can say we're going to pay $15 an hour, $12. They could, to win bids by forever pushing lower the wages. And then project labor agreement, with the wonderful infrastructure law that was passed under Biden-Harris, and Harris provided the pivotal vote to enable it to pass because not a single Republican senator backed it. There are hundreds of billions of dollars being spent to build roads, bridges, tunnels, airports, creating lots of good paying construction jobs, many of them unionized. And basically by saying we want to get rid of the Project 2025 says, let's get a project labor agreements, which kind of help assure that these are union jobs, and let's get rid of prevailing wage. This is going to be very bad for construction workers and will fatten the profits of construction companies and basically reduce pay and benefits for construction workers. What else does it do? It calls for, they propose getting rid of all public sector unions. So again, all these police officers, all these firefighters, support Trump. They say he's great. But, Trump's folks, Project 2025, they want to get rid of police unions and firefighters unions and teachers unions. And one of the best tools for unions nowadays is card check. When you don't want to get into a huge fight with management where they have their anti-union consultants and intimidate workers to vote against the union. So you very quickly try to get a majority of workers to sign up to support the union. So, and that's called card check. And Project 2025 calls for absolutely banning card check. You can't use it to win a union. And lastly, I could talk another half an hour about this, but the last thing I'll say is, yes, it calls for forming company unions. It says companies should be allowed to form these, employee involvement committees. That's what, so that management could designate certain employees to sit in meetings with managers to discuss problems. and management is totally free. It controls who's chosen, and management is totally free to ignore whatever these committee recommends. And management wants these employee involvement committees to say, see, we really take worker voice into account. You don't need a union anymore. And the law prohibits such fake unions, such company unions, such sweetheart unions,
yeah,
because they really don't give workers any power, and they might discourage some workers from forming a union. And this is another thing that kind of is fake friendship for workers.
Yeah, I call them the suggestion box unions because, you can put whatever you want in the box. Nobody's reading those. They find their way right to the circular file.
Let me say one other thing, Rick. So the Republicans, Trump, they're all about the conservatives on the Supreme Court. They're all about weakening the administrative state, weakening the federal government. If you read the labor chapter of Project 2025, it's all about increasing the powers of the Labor Department to make life miserable for union officials. They'll allow far more investigations of unions. They require many more disclosures from unions. And it's like, Project 2025 was probably financed by big corporations and billionaires who are not in love with unions and don't want, workers to have much of a voice. So the one part of the administrative state they're happy to have grow more bigger and more powerful is the one that kind of steps on unions.
Yeah, will be the one that they use as a bludgeon to harm workers. So last question I've got for you, because we're now in this a real race and an exciting race. And I think back to the RNC convention where Teamsters President Sean O'Brien went and said some nice words about Vance and Marshall and some other Republicans. How do you think that speech now, given what we're seeing coming out of Harris-Walz ticket, how do you think those words are going to be remembered?
I was discussing that over lunch a few hours ago with a friend from Michigan. And, on one hand, he did say a lot of good stuff in this speech. He said, the laws, make it very hard to unionize. It's too easy for corporations to fire workers and very hard to get them back. And so there was some good stuff. But yes, I totally agree with you, Rick. He kissed up too much to J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley. And I wrote that, some of these Republicans have taken baby steps to show their supposed support for unions.
Yep.
Yes, Hawley. Yes, Vance have walked on picket lines, but I really can't think of any pro-worker laws that they voted for. They're not for a higher minimum wage. They're not for labor's number one legislative priority, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, to make it easier to unionize. They voted against the infrastructure bill, which would which is creating hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs. A lot of people go to college, do fine nowadays, but a lot of people whose kids don't go to college, the kids are struggling. And it's good to create for this infrastructure bill because it creates great jobs for a lot of people who don't go to college.
Yeah.
And Vance voted against this, and Hawley voted against. So O'Brien was trying to show, I want to talk to Republicans, I want to talk to Democrats, I want everyone to listen to me, I want to be fair-minded. There are some Teamsters who support Trump, and I don't want to turn my back on them. But, Trump... and I've written this many times, Trump did virtually nothing for workers when he was president. He did nothing to raise the abysmally low minimum wage. He says he was all for coal miners. His administration reduced safety standards for coal miners. He said he was going to do miracles for coal miners during his 4 years as president. Employment for coal miners fell by 25%. Great, great Donald Trump. His National Labor Relations Board, was very, very anti-union, tried to make it much harder for workers to unionize. His appointees to the Supreme Court. Anyway, Trump is not a friend of workers.
Yeah.
And so O'Brien is trying to persuade Trump and the Republican Party to be more pro-union, be more pro-worker. And as you and I, as you said, and I wrote, Rick, unfortunately, he's a show pony, show horse, where the Republicans are using his speech to show, look, we're no longer anti-worker, we're no longer anti-union. The great president of the Teamsters came to speak to us. But now Kamala Harris, appointed, we were debating whether appointed Tim Walz, we were debating whether there's ever been anyone else on the Democratic national ticket who was a union member. We couldn't think of anyone, but I'm not sure. Yes, Reagan was head of the Screen Actors Guild, but It's like, you know, Walsh is anything the Teamsters president could dream for, anyone a union president could dream for. So I imagine a lot of teams are going to say, wait a second, you know, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to, you know, to cozy up to the Republicans. Maybe, you know, Kamala's doing a very good job. You know, she supports raising the minimum wage. She supports pay, you know, all these things Republicans oppose, raising the minimum wage, paid family leave, passing and protecting the right to organize, you know, restoring women's control over their bodies. So I think more and more Teamsters will be saying to Sean O'Brien, you know, the Democrats are looking better and better. Maybe it wasn't such a good idea to talk to the, to speak at the RNC. Maybe, you know, we should get on board with the Democratic train and endorse Kamala and Tim.
There it is. Steve, I appreciate the time. As always, great work. Keep it up. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Okay, thanks.
Our good friend Stephen Greenhouse. Make sure you check out his work over at The Guardian, also over at Slate.com. We'll get links on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cool and mostly clear tonight, a low near 50. Mostly sunny tomorrow, cool for August, highs upper 60s. Beautiful weekend ahead, sunshine and a high in the low 70s Saturday, mid-70s Sunday. Sunday night, Monday, a few clouds and a slight chance of rain. Currently 57 degrees.
Earl Ingram.
Let's go to Lynn for Oconomowoc.
I met Kamala and she's super intelligent. She will select people who are competent in their field.
So, Sandy, you don't hear those words when it comes to the other guy.
Well, he's going to select loyal people. Project 2025 seems to diminish the notion that there needs to be competence in government.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this week we got some really good news from a D.C. circuit judge that said, hey, Google, monopoly. And look, by declaring Google a monopoly and, you know, saying that somewhere down the road we got to do something to fix this, it has opened up kind of the floodgates of people going, hey, Google's a monopoly. How about now try AC units or food production or grocery stores or telecom media? How about we restore competition to our entire economy? Wow, wouldn't that be something? And share some thoughts on maybe how we get there and maybe who could be doing that. I've asked my good friend Jeff Hauser to come talk with us. Jeff is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project, the revolvingdoorproject.org, the website. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be here.
So let's start with the decision. Thoughts?
It's a terrific sign. For years, antitrust had kind of gone into the wilderness. It was an area of law. You know, the origins of antitrust law go back to the common law. They'll go back to England before the United States was a country. But then statute was written in 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act. A different statute was written during the Progressive Era in 1914, the Clayton Act. And these laws, they remain the law of the land, but between right-wing judges, between the right-wing legal movement, people like Robert Bork and the Federalist Society, and honestly, some neoliberal Democrats, antitrust law had kind of disappeared as a meaningful force in America. And what that meant is that powerful companies could get ever more powerful, and they didn't have to compete well to do so. They could do tricky stuff. And that's basically what the district court ruled here. After an extensive trial and a 277-page opinion, Judge Mehta ruled, and it's kind of ironic, his name is Judge Mehta because there are federal lawsuits now being brought against Facebook, right, AKA Meta. But Judge Mehta ruled that not only is Google, which goes by the name of Alphabet right now, but that not only is Google a monopolist in the field of search, but that they have maintained and expanded their monopoly via non-competitive means. So it's not just, hey, they're really good. It's that they're cheating to be that dominant, because it's not actually illegal to be a monopoly. It can be illegal to what you do with your monopoly or how you maintain it. And in this case, the judge said that Google is building and maintaining its monopoly in illegal ways. And so the judge will still be considering what to do about it. But this is a big problem for Google and a very good sign for the U.S. economy.
Now, walk back to what you said there for a second, because that there can be a monopoly. It's just what you do to get there. Because I think that's, because one of the responses I got from people, well, I like Google. You're going to make me not be able to use Google? And no, that's not the point here, is it?
Right. I mean, so Google pays Apple $20 billion or so, sometimes more, a year to be the default search engine on Apple products. And yeah, maybe if that money wasn't there, Apple would give people a lot of options and people would choose Google. Certainly possible, right? But I don't think Google is spending $20 billion a year out of the goodness of their heart. And nor does the judge. After hearing the trial, and Google had very highly qualified lawyers, they had well-paid experts, they had a chance to present their case, and the government overcame their arguments. So yeah, if Google was doing this totally on the merits and they weren't taking advantage of it, then they would get away with it. But that's not the case. And it just makes no sense that you would pay $20 billion plus in order to compete on the merits.
So like I said, I've been getting a lot of emails from people saying, you know, now that the judges decided this, how about the wider range of other industries where this happens? And grocery stores came up, you know, because, you know, if what you're saying, you know, Google is buying the default setting on your smartphones on Apple, which don't they have their own search engine that's crummy?
No, see, Apple doesn't even have a crummy search engine. And that's that is a lot of what Google is buying.
Oh, I thought they had what was it? The Safari or Bing?
That's for browser.
Oh, okay. Now there's the difference. See, now this is where things get a little different, because, you know, that plays into it. But you were saying they're buying this positioning. You know, how's that any different than when you go to the supermarket and, you know, this brand gets the end cap over this brand, and it's because they're paying for it? How's that any different then?
It's not totally different, and it can definitely be problematic that they are buying that access. I mean, it depends on how dominant the position is and what the obstacles are to people getting into the supermarket. But it is definitely the case that Americans are paying too much for food, and that there is a lack of competition across that entire sphere of the economy, be it farmers who have to buy products from Monsanto and they get locked into certain intellectual property on the pesticides they use and the seeds that they use, and all the way to where the farmers sell, who are the middlemen that purchase directly from the farmers before it gets to the, you know, food processors and the supermarkets. The entire system is kind of gross. There's a guy, Austin Frerich, wrote a book called Barons about the food industry, and he goes through seven different monopolists within the food industry, but it's not that there are only seven. So be it Walmart or Cargill or this one company that sells a really high percentage of the world's coffee, there are monopolies across the food space. And that's part, that consolidated market that is protected by problematic practices. That's a lot of the reason why prices went up so much during the pandemic. It's obviously not the only cause, but it's a big cause.
Well, it's a big cause because they had the ability to do it and quickly do it to where there was no competitive force. Because we're told at Econ 101 that if one person raises their prices, the other person could keep their prices the same or maybe lower them to grab market share. That didn't happen because there was no competition for that to happen in. And that's why I think this decision could be opening the door a crack to maybe restoring some of that, or am I being too optimistic?
No, it's a good sign, because what it shows is that, A, people were able to get Joe Biden to appoint people who were steadfast and had spines to key jobs. So that's like Jonathan Cantor at the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department, which brought this case. There's Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission, who's bringing cases against Facebook and a whole bunch of other industries, pharmaceutical companies and the like. So we succeeded in that regard. It shows that a judge who, you know, seems to have had all sorts of sympathies to big law and been a traditionalist in the past can be persuaded to move in a populist direction. I don't think people thought the Justice Department was necessarily going to win this lawsuit when it was begun and they drew this judge. He was kind of a technocrat who'd been sympathetic to corporations in the past, but they were able to persuade this judge. And this shows that even if you have fewer attorneys who are paid less well with less well-paid economic experts, the American people and their representatives in court can win. So it's definitely very encouraging.
It is very encouraging. But again, for me, this is one of those, you know, and it comes back to, you know, who's in the White House. And I know right now you've got people like Reid Hoffman, you know, trying to convince, you know, Kamala Harris to fire Lina Khan and go in a different direction from inside the House. But outside, you've got Republicans who most certainly want to see her gone. This is kind of one of those political things where, you know, I'm looking at Kamala Harris and Tim Walz as hopefully the people who will pick this up and continue it on into the future. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts of you know, Kamala at the top of the ticket and this big news of the new VP choice?
Yeah, I mean, so Vice President Harris had an okay record on antitrust back when she was Attorney General of California, which was during an era in which the Democratic Party was not wholeheartedly embracing antitrust. But she's been obviously the number two member of an administration that has revitalized antitrust enforcement. And I think people in the administration are generally very proud of the record of the Biden team on this. And Harris has been referencing a lot of arguments that come out of the antitrust enforcers in her early days as a candidate. Lina Khan and the FTC unearthed evidence that suggests that Texas shale oil producers were conspiring with OPEC plus countries to raise fossil fuel prices. So, you know, like the storyline that Trump would like to tell is that gas prices went up because we have environmentalists in the White House. But actually, it turns out like the Saudi royals and the Texas oil billionaires, you know, they're cheating, which should surprise absolutely nobody. But it was Lina Khan who unearthed that. And just in her first day as a presidential candidate, Harris was invoking that as the type of thing that she was going to fight against. And that was unearthed by Lina Khan. So I'd like to believe that given how the party has shifted, that Kamala Harris is a talented politician who understands the nature of the political party she is representing and the political moment we're in which even some conservatives like J.D. Vance are trying to say some nice things about Lina Khan. I'd like to think she understands that the politics are that to lean into the record of the Biden administration on antitrust, to lean into the records of people like Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor. I'm optimistic about that. And I think that is the direction that a Tim Walz as governor would suggest she's going to take, because Tim Walz has a populist anti-monopoly record as governor of Minnesota. So I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic that figures like Reid Hoffman are going to be disappointed, the tech oligarchs will be disappointed, and that Harris and Walz will build on the Biden-Harris legacy on antitrust. But obviously, the more activists can say that that is critical to them and critical to their ongoing support, you know, the more likely that my optimism bears out.
No, I mean, I look at this, and for all of this inflationary period, I've been calling on the Senate, you know, the president, you know, appoint some commissions, you know, like the old Truman Commission going after war profiteers. Bring these people in, humiliate them in public for gouging the American consumers. And you know, this story that popped up, why hasn't there been a congressional investigation in this? Why are there no criminal charges? Why isn't this what we're seeing front and center on the evening news every night?
I mean, so like there are some steps being taken. It looks like the Justice Department is investigating after the Federal Trade Commission made the referral. During an investigation, you don't expect the executive branch, at least the law enforcement people within it to be, you know, that public. Senator Chairs, White House and Sanders have done stuff on this, but they've not yet succeeded in bringing anyone in front of them. Subpoenas, to my point of view, are issued too slowly and too rarely by Congress. I think this is an urgent issue, and I'd like to see people sitting before the Senate sooner rather than later. And if they resist, they should refer back to the Justice Department to like forcibly bring these people in front of Senate, because that is a power that Congress and the Justice Department have to enforce subpoenas. And finally, like we were actually last fall, we were urging the Biden administration to make Kamala Harris the leader of efforts on corporate crackdown, because no matter how much we respect President Biden, we could tell even then that his communications capacity was not optimal. And what we were specifically recommending that Vice President Harris do is call out some of these corporate price manipulators by name. Try to pick fights. So I think the way to make this on the nightly news, the way to get this a big deal on social media, is to have back and forth, to have the fight engaged. Because right now, a lot of these business leaders are not defending themselves publicly. But the more personal Vice President Harris would be to get, or Tim Walz would get, like we know Tim Walz can get under people's skin. And it would be great to unleash him on some of these fat cat fossil fuel producers, or the people who are, there's this company RealPage, which helps landlords conspire to raise the rent on people. Let's call out these CEOs. Let's call out these fat cats by name, make life uncomfortable, cause them to respond. Because once they respond, then it's on.
Yeah,
then there's a fight, and then I think the attention will follow.
No, the attention will follow. Because look at how much mileage Josh Hawley got out of that berating of the Boeing CEO. In fact, you know, got the Teamsters president. And, you know, hey, people like Josh Hawley are out there fighting for working people. Look at what he's doing. And look, in his best interest, he did that. Not because I think he cares about working people, but because it got him a lot of attention. So I think that message, you know, start picking some fights is not a bad one.
Yeah. I mean, American people constantly make clear that they want to see that you are willing to fight, that the act of being in, like, the problem was Biden was actually unleashing people to do good fights, but it was at odds with his individual persona at the age of 81. And that is not a problem that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz have. And they can do this more credibly on a much broader range of topics of interest to working people, to their family, to their lives, than Trump or Vance can do. And they should take advantage of that, because their values are in the right place, but they need to demonstrate those values by visibly fighting and being seen to be fighting.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you on this, because you know, you've laid out what I think the Biden administration has done right, and again, why I think that this should continue. And I hope with Harris and Walz, a little bit more bite in the dog, and we start, you know, really going after them. How did we get here, though? I mean, you know, I look at the Trump administration. I don't remember much of this. Now, the Google thing, I'm told, was started by Billy Barr, but for an entirely different reason than competition. It was to go after kind of a political enemy, as I read it. I'm curious how you think the Trump administration did in this world.
I think they did not do well, but they began to turn around the ship. They adopted populist language on antitrust. They appointed more at the DOJ than at the Federal Trade Commission. They appointed a chief who spoke differently than his predecessors under George W. Bush. And as you said, they continued one of Nixon's legacies. Nixon, one of the forgotten scandals of the Watergate was that Nixon scuttled an antitrust investigation. He literally took $1 million bribe from a company and then got the Justice Department to close an investigation. And $1 million in 1973 was, you know, real money.
Yeah.
Not that I scoff at it right now. They did stuff for political reasons. They went after the Time Warner AT&T merger, but that was to complain about CNN coverage of Donald Trump. So they were fighting corporate America But as always, it was in service of one person, Donald Trump, not the American people.
And there it comes back to.
They took on more of a fighting persona, but it was really genuinely insincere.
Well, we will see what happens. I'm excited about this ticket, and I think good things can happen. But Jeff, I appreciate the time as always. Keep up the great work there at the Revolving Door Project. Hope folks will check out the website, therevolvingdoorproject.org. Jeff Hauser, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts. Is this an exciting opportunity to maybe bring competition back to the economy? You know, maybe you have more than, you know, one or two companies or three controlling industry after industry. I want to hear it. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the day that two tailors who were out on strike in New York City were killed in a confrontation with the police. It is thought that they were the first workers to die while participating in a strike in the United States. They certainly would not be the last. The United States has one of the bloodiest labor histories of any industrial nation. It's estimated that at least 700 people have lost their lives to violence during a strike. The vast majority of those slain were workers. Some of the most bloody conflicts included the Great Upheaval of 1877, where across the country, 100 workers lost their lives in an uprising of railway labor. Then, in 1892, the strike against Carnegie Steel in Homestead, Pennsylvania, 9 strikers and 3 Pinkerton agents died. 2 years later, 30 workers died across the country in a boycott and strike against the Pullman Palace Car Company. One of the most infamous labor massacres occurred in Ludlow, Colorado in 1914. During this coal mining strike, gun thugs hired by the company rained machine gun bullets and fire down on a tent colony of striking workers. At least 19 people were killed. 11 of them were children. In 1937, 10 workers died on Memorial Day at a demonstration against Republic Steel in Chicago. These are just some of the battles, massacres, and murders that shaped the American labor movement. Too often, the toil of this bloodshed is not taught in history classes. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the energy on the Democrat side, I got to tell you, nothing you could have imagined, nothing you could have planned for. And I've had people tell me that, you know, Joe Biden plotted all this. You know, it's interesting listening to the right. Either he's, you know, inept and incompetent and demented, or, you know, all of that stuff that you hear, or he's an evil genius. He's the guy who in the basement learned coding so that he could steal the election. And he's such a genius that he dreamt up this amazing energy so that he can come in. And this is the part that I love best. It's not that he just dreamt up this whole scenario to whip Donald Trump, but he's going to come back. He's going to rise and he's going to take it all back at the convention, which is, you know, again, fantasy talk. But understand, this is what the right has done masterfully for years. They have fleeced the flock. They've got people brainwashed into believing some really crazy stuff. You know, what would have been the first attacks against Tim Walz? You know, Tampon Tim, he put tampons in every bathroom. Okay, so, and? Well, they're not everywhere else. Okay, and? Nothing. But again, that's what they've got. And now they're trying to swift boat him. Oh, he stole valor. No, this guy's never been that guy. And good, keep doing what you're doing, because it shows that you have nothing. The more you attack on ridiculous grounds that aren't factual and aren't even close to reality, the more the reachable red hats. And there are going to be a lot. because I do foresee in a very short period of time, we're going to see a lot of the folks taking off the red hats. They're already taking down the flags out in front of their house. They're already starting to move away from being as loud and obnoxious in crowds. They're already not showing up to their events. There's going to be a moment very soon when the red hats are like, well, you know, I got off that train, you know, before it derailed. Because I don't know if you've noticed, it's derailing. You know, Trump is really spiraling out of control because he has no idea what to do. They have no idea how to handle this. They have no idea how to attack these two because, understand, they've got an agenda to run on. Biden has set them on the right course that the American people want. And they're not doing the whole Mother May I thing. These are Gen Xers. These are people who grew up, you know, drinking out of hoses in the backyard, you know, not coming home till the streetlights are on. These are people who are the, you know, mess around and find out generation. And Trump has no idea how to handle this. These are the, you know, the question authority people. These are the folks who, when he opens his mouth in a debate, Kamala Harris is going to shut it for him. And that's what's got them freaked out. This isn't Hillary Clinton, you know, playing prim and proper by the rules, being the smartest person in the room, but still following the rules. These are people who are going to smack back. And they have no idea how to deal with this. And look at how fast they're trying to backtrack from Project 2025. This is their agenda. This is what they've sold their donors on the future of the country being. The pendulum of power swinging more towards the wealthy big corporations and away from, you know, those labor unions and those activists who are demanding things. It's more towards a centralized power of a few and quelling the masses, the unwashed masses. And they're very clear about it. It's well documented in the 900 pages. And there was supposed to be a book that was going to come out. They've delayed the release of the book. Evidently, they don't want everyone to read it, I guess. But you can go find the Project 2025 online. Understand, J.D. Vance, a friend of the guy who was the head of the Heritage Foundation there, he wrote the foreword for the book. The book Dawn's Early Light. Yeah. Welcome back to the Gilded Age. And in fact, you had Stephen Miller, one of Trump's few remaining aides from the previous administration who stuck around, who was instrumental in this, was on MSNBC for the sole purpose of distancing Trump from Project 2025. Very, very weird kind of moment we're in. Because they know they don't have an agenda the American people want. They know they don't have policies that are going to make workers' lives better. They know they have no idea how to bring down inflation. All they can do is point, yell, scream, it's all Joe Biden's fault. All they know how to do is use problems to cause division and not have the solutions to fix those problems. You may not agree with a solution, but at least Democrats are trying. Now, I happen to agree with what Joe Biden has done. I happen to think he's moved the ship in the right direction. I happen to believe that Harris and Walz are going to pick up that mantle and are going to march us right into prosperity, a better future for our kids, a planet that maybe we can pass off to the next generation with some pride. And oh, by the way, doing it while making lives better. Because for all the talk of Minneapolis is burning, it's a hellscape, it's an apocalyptic nightmare. It's one of the happiest places on earth. One of the best places to raise a family. And oh, by the way, they do it while feeding children breakfast and lunch. They do it while ensuring that workers are safe at work. They do it while ensuring that families, when they get sick, can take a day off and not lose pay. They do it by making lives better and having policies that help make lives better. And isn't that what we want at the national level? Isn't this what we should be fighting for? I think so. And I got to tell you, I love me some Tim Walz. The Harris-Walz ticket, probably the best VP poll in my lifetime, hands down. Want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. If you miss any portion of the program, podcast, freespeech.org. That's where you get the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.